On Sunday, May 15th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents Margaret Porter Troop and Quincy Troop. Join us as we discuss the relationship between Miles Davis and Quincy Troop and learn how that relationship helps the Gloucester Project in Mississippi as we help keep this listener-supported experiment alive. That's Sunday, May 15th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. Our guests for this evening, Margaret Porter Troop and Quincy Troop. And they're going to discuss an event, a Harlem Arts Salon event that's taking place on Miles Davis's birthday, May 26th, in celebration of Miles Davis. Stay tuned. And of course, this gives us a wonderful opportunity to play a lot from the Miles Davis catalog. We are also in fundraising mode for the spring membership drive, so we will be asking for your support, your continued support, by calling 516-620-3206, 516-620-3206, or go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And what we're offering this evening is the book Miles and Me by Quincy Troop. It sort of documents the relationship between Quincy Troop and Miles Davis. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
In my bowl. Thank you.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Margaret Porter Troop.
Quincy Troop.
Thank you so much, Margaret Porter Troop and Quincy Troop, for joining Sugar in My Bowl. Really appreciate your spending the time with us.
Thank you for asking us.
Now, I'm going to start off with you, Margaret, pretty much because you're the logistical person. Well, first off, let me say that we're talking because there's an event coming up on the 26th, celebrating Miles Davis. You want to tell us about that event, Margaret?
Yes, we're having a birthday celebration to celebrate the anniversary of Miles Davis's birthday on May 26th at the Harlem Art Salon. And had Miles Davis lived, he would have been 90 years old on May 26th. And it's part of the Harlem Art Salon programming, which is a benefit for a summer arts project that I do in Gloucester, Mississippi. I take six artists from New York down to Gloucester, Mississippi during the summer months to give a free 3 weeks art camp to kids ages 7 to 17 years old and to introduce them to the basics of poetry, guitar, drumming, visual arts, painting, drawing, silkscreen printing, dance, theater.
Okay.
So these are kids who have never had access to the arts before, and it's a summer program to give them something to do during the summer. These are kids in this small town where I grew up, and it's my way of giving back to the community that raised me. They are members of the community, and they are ages 6 to 17 or 7 to 17. They have to have at least 1 year of schooling from first grade through 12th grade.
So how is it decided what children will participate?
All children are welcome as long as they meet the age criteria.
Okay.
Yeah. I take six artists down from New York. Danny Glover comes down and encourages the kids. He spends a day or two down with them and gives them a talk and gives them encouragement and gives them a pat on the back and a little talk about the value of using their imagination and how important their ideas are and how much we love them and how much we want to see them succeed. So he comes down every summer to Gloucester, Mississippi, to support the program. And last year, Terry McMillan also came down, as well as a good friend of mine who's an architect. Alexa Donovan came down. And these kind of role models, these kind of people, professional, creative people, are role models for the kids.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's great.
Quincy Troop, my husband, goes.
Okay.
Just poetry. Kelvin Bell, who's a musician, a guitarist, and musical theater director, is the program director for the Gloucester Arts Project. Nambi Kelly, who's a playwright and actress, comes. And Carlos Uribe, who is a visual artist and silkscreen printer, he comes.
Oh.
Ebony Golden, who's a dancer and movement specialist.
Oh, Ebony Golden. We know her. She does arts on Wednesday, Women on Wednesdays.
Oh, yes. Ebony is one of my teaching artists.
Oh, wonderful.
She comes. So it's Ebony, Rachel Eliza Griffiths, who's a photographer and a poet, comes. And this is our third year of going to Gloucester and giving these kids a free arts camp.
Around what period does it?
It's in July, and the kids get 3 weeks of free summer arts camp. It starts at 8:30 in the morning and ends at 2:30 in the afternoon every day for 5 days, and we give them a healthy lunch every day. I provide housing for the artist, transportation. I give them an honorarium. So it's pretty costly. So every year I have to raise tons of money to be able to do this. But I know from my own experience how valuable the arts are in terms of giving one self-esteem. There are so many other values that the kids have, but most important of all, the value of believing that their ideas, their imagination matter. What they think matters. It gives them confidence. It gives them some understanding of creativity and the fact that they themselves are creative beings. And so it's my way of giving back to that community, but also to try to mitigate some of the social and economic challenges that they face.
What? Yo, David, we know what you're doing. Got that girl in there. Smoking that marijuana. Got your demand for you.
Late for somebody's here. Chingat. What's that? Cuffing?
Handcuffs.
Handcuff some of this time.
You're the shortest. We know you.
Wait a minute, I gotta do something for me.
It's too late. We got you.
Get some of this.
We've been following you in that yellow Ferrari.
Hey man, that wasn't no Ferrari. You must have been following the cab. Arrest some of this.
You have a right to make one phone call. So you better show.
Cokolwiek nie powiesz, będzie użyte przeciwko tobie, więc lepiej siedź cicho.
Yo vine de Miami y este es parte de mi religión. Y no me diga que me calle.
Tu as le droit de tenir le silence. Rien comme tu va se dire contre toi. Alors, c'est toi.
Et toi, somebody.
They are primarily public school kids. Mississippi is notorious for not funding public education. They are notorious for neglecting these children who become fodder, I think, for the industrial prison complex.
Right.
There are a number of prisons, I think there are like five, within the 50-mile radius of that small town.
My goodness.
And the town itself, most businesses have left that town. There's not a lot of jobs. We hire local people there. We bring money to the community because we patronize local businesses there. We patronize hotels, bed and breakfast, restaurants, and all the other little retail stores there. So when we come, we bring not only the arts to the community and these artists and mentors for these children, but we also bring commerce. And the arts are really notorious for generating and being a catalyst catalyst for economic development. That's one of the motivations also for my doing this, because I think that it's the only contribution I know that I can give personally, because I've been involved in the arts over 30 years, you know, producing cultural events. Mm-hmm. I think that it's incumbent on people, on us, to give back to our own communities. I think we have to take the initiative, and we can't wait around for things to change because other people invest. We have to do the investment ourselves and then, you know, inspire other people to follow our examples. So that's why I'm doing the Gloucester Arts Project. And my background has been doing these kinds of arts education programs. I did it when I was in California and I had an art gallery. I did it in New York before we moved to California. And I have just continued to do it. Now I'm doing it in my hometown in Mississippi, in Gloucester. But the Harlem Art Salon is what I do here in Harlem, inviting writers and musicians and visual artists to come in an intimate setting in our home here in the tradition of the Harlem Renaissance artists and patrons who used to do it back in the 30s,
right,
to support our creative people. I think that we also owe it to our living writers and artists to support them, to make a platform available to them so that they can move their products, whether it be paintings, whether it be books, whether it be music or whatever. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So the Harlem Art Salon, I started in 2004, and I've had people like Toni Morrison here. I've had Ron Carter. I've had so many different kinds of artists here of great reputation and distinction. So Miles Davis, because Quincy, my husband, has been one of the reasons that I got into the arts when I met him. He was in the center of the artist community here. He was working as the artistic director for the Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center, and used to run arts workshops in the Black Roots Festival, I think almost 30 years.
Wow.
And using his example, I also got involved in doing that kind of work.
Thank you.
Quincy, you know, wrote Miles Davis's autobiography, Miles, exactly. The Autobiography, and he also wrote
Miles and Me.
Miles and Me.
Which we're going to talk about later.
And he's written a screenplay based on Miles and Me. It's going to be a major movie. But in any case, I got to know Miles Davis during the time that Quincy was working with him and grew to love and respect him tremendously and understand the contributions that he's made to culture, world culture.
Right.
And wanted to celebrate his life, especially now that it's almost a century since he died. And I wanted to gather together people like Quincy and other people who've worked with him, who admired and loved him as well, together to celebrate him in a way that I don't think that movie, Miles Ahead, I don't think that celebrated him properly. And I thought, well, let's do something to really acknowledge his contributions in a way that is not derogatory or a caricature, which is what I think that movie is. That's my own personal opinion.
Yeah, I feel pretty much the same way.
Yeah, I just think, you know, that for someone who's contributed so enormously to music and just to culture in general, he's, in my opinion, he's one of the great geniuses of the latter centuries. And I just wanted to try to do something to acknowledge that in my own personal way, as well as to use it as a fundraiser for what we're trying to do down in Gloucester, Mississippi.
Which is an excellent idea. Are the guests confirmed?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would like to mention that some of the guests on hand, trumpeter Wallace Roney, who is pretty much under the tutelage of Miles Davis.
Yes, and, Eric Parent, I say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he channels Miles often.
Yeah.
Gary Bartz, who worked with Miles Davis. Adam Holtzman, also worked with Miles Davis. Tommy LaPuma, who was a producer, Columbia Records, I believe.
Yep.
Earl the Pearl Monroe.
Yes.
Now, I'm not quite sure what their relationship is. What is that?
It was a personal friendship.
Okay.
I think they were neighbors at one point.
Okay.
And he was a great admirer of his music as well.
Wonderful. It'll be great seeing him anyway.
Yeah.
And Quincy Troupe.
Yes, and Quincy Troupe. And we also are going to have Sherry Brockman has confirmed that she will be here. She's AKA Peaches. She had a personal relationship with him.
Okay.
And who else? Lena Sherrod is going to come and say a few words. And
Lena Sherrod is?
Lena Sherrod is a journalist who knew Miles also.
Okay.
I think we didn't mention James M. Toomey.
No, but I saw his name somewhere else. I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah, he's going to be there.
Yay.
Tommy LaPuma was Miles' last producer, and I knew him really, 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 really well.
Uh-huh.
And Earl Monroe, as Margaret said, was a good friend of Miles because Miles loves sports. Mm-hmm. And he really loved Earl Monroe as a basketball player. They knew each other, and so we asked him to come. I wrote his book, Earl the Pearl Monroe.
Yes.
I wrote that book with him, so I asked him if he would come, and he really wanted to come. There's going to be some other surprise guests.
Yeah.
Also, you know, that we haven't confirmed now that will be there. Really, really, really interesting people that knew Miles and really are making their mark in the film world and in the music world. So we're going to have some other people that are going to be there also.
Well, there's already like a list of interesting people already, including yourselves, who will be there. So that's going to be amazing already.
I think the only thing that I could add is that after the 3 weeks, what the kids do is put on an end of camp performance where their parents and the community get to see what they've learned, and they get to show off their talents at the end of the camp, which is like the highlight of the whole thing. And it's just so magical to see these children light up when they discover just how talented they are, just how imaginative that they are, and to see their ideas come to fruition makes everything worth the whole effort that it takes. And it's a gargantuan effort to get this done. Well, I just wanted to thank you for asking and giving me the time to talk about it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for providing the salons.
Okay.
You're listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. My guests for this evening are Quincy Troop and Margaret Porter Troop, and we've been listening to them discuss the Gloucester Project, and there's an event that's going to take place on the 26th of this month on Miles Davis's birthday to help keep that institution functioning. And tonight we're asking you for your support for a pledge of $35. We will give you, as a thank you gift, Miles and Me, which was written by Quincy Troop, and it documents the relationship between Miles Davis and Quincy Troop. We need your support by calling 516-620-3206, 516-620-3206, or go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org for a pledge of $35. That book can be yours as a thank you gift for your generous support. What you're listening to right now is Seven Steps to Heaven. That's Miles Davis, the title track from the 1963 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, George Coleman on tenor sax, Herbie Hancock on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Tony Williams on drums. Before that, we heard Miles Runs the Voodoo Down, Miles Davis Quintet, Live in Europe, 1969, The Bootleg Series, Volume 2. Miles Davis on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on tenor and soprano sax, Chick Corea on electric piano and piano, Dave Holland on bass, Jack DeJohnette on drums, and that is a 2013 Sony Records release. Before that, we heard Phone Call Street Scenes from Miles Davis's You're Under Arrest, 1985 Columbia Records. Miles Davis on trumpet, police voice, Bob Berg on soprano sax, Al Foster on drums, Robert Irving III on synthesizers, Daryl the Munch Jones on bass, John Schofield on guitar, Steve Thornton on percussion and Spanish voice, Sting, French policeman's voice, Marek Giko, G-I-K-O, the Polish voice, James J.R. Prindville on handcuffs. And before that, we heard the title track, Water Babies, from the Columbia Records 1968 release, Miles Davis on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on tenor sax, Herbie Hancock on piano, Ron Carter on bass, Tony Williams on drums. Before that, we heard Swing Spring, Miles Davis and the Modern Giants from Miles Davis' 1956 Prestige Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Milt Jackson on vibes, Thelonious Monk on piano, Al Chambers on bass, John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, Philly Joe Jones on drums. Before that, we heard Black Satin from Miles Davis's On the Corner 1972 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Teo Maceo on saxophone, Badal Roy on tabla, John McLaughlin on guitar, Colin Walcott on sitar, Chick Corea on keyboard, Harold L. Williams Jr. on keyboard, Dave Liebman on tenor saxophone, Billy Hart on drums and percussion, Don Elias on percussion, and Jack DeJeanette on drums. And before that, we opened the program with our theme, Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. That's an RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and he will tell you what's happening around town with our former Sugar guests. Stay tuned for more by calling 516-620-3206 or going to give2wbai.org. That's 516-620-3206 or give2wbai.org. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for May 15th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's guests are poet and author Quincy Troupe and Margaret Troupe. You can see both of them, along with saxophonist Gary Bartz, percussionist James Mtume, at the Harlem Art Salon on the 26th for a Miles Davis birthday event. Details for that are at harlemartssalon.com, and we'll have it linked on our website. This is normally the time when we go into the shows of the week, and we'll do that in a moment, but this is a fun drive show for our home station of WBAI Radio, which needs your support to stay on the air and to keep us on the air. The number for pledges is 516-620-3206. That's 516-620-3206. You can pledge as little as $5 or consider becoming a sustaining member with a monthly pledge. And we've put together a special premium for you. We have 10 autographed copies of Quincy Troupe's book Miles and Me available for a pledge of $35 to WBAI. The book is his remembrances of knowing and working with Davis on his autobiography, and in addition to personal insights, has some coverage of the music as well. Again, the number is 516-620-3206, or you can go online and we'll have the page linked at both our website and blog. Now for this week's listings. Aza, the exhibit of drummer Will Calhoun's visual art collaboration, is on display at the Casita Maria Center for Arts and Education in the South Bronx until July 21st, and you can see a preview of the show on our blog. Calhoun is also at Blue Note on the 30th with pianist McCoy Tyner. Drummer J.T. Lewis is with cellist Marika Hughes on the 16th at the Blue Note. Bassist Bob Cranshaw is at Cassandra's Jazz Club in Harlem on the 16th. Tubist Howard Johnson is at the Harlem Afternoon Jazz Series at Rendell Memorial Presbyterian Church for two lunchtime sets on the 17th. Details are at harlemjazzbox.com, and that's harlemjazzbox with two X's, .com. The Mac Power Trio of saxophonist David Murray, pianist Jerry Allen, and drummer Terry Lynn Carrington is at Birdland from the 17th to the 21st, performing songs from their new Perfection release. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 18th. Vocalist Tana Alexa is at 55 Bar on the 18th and 20th. Harpist Brandy Younger is at Tavern on the Lake in East Windsor, New Jersey on the 20th. pianist and vocalist Diane Shore is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Rose Theater from the 20th to 21st. Low brass specialist on tuba Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 21st. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria is at the Tribeca Performing Arts Center at Borough Manhattan Community College on the 21st for the Made in New York Gala, and he leads Quartetto Ache at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark on the 27th with Latino Poets. Percussionist Adam Rudolph has a residency at the Stone from the 24th to 29th, and Graham Haynes joins him on the 25th, 27th, and 28th. Trumpeter Marcus Printup is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club with the JALC Orchestra from the 25th to the 26th. And saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin leads the Soul Squad at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club on the 31st. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarandmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news, and Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there also. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. Reminder, autographed copies of Quincy Troupe's Miles and Me are available for a $35 pledge, which includes WBAI membership. So you can call 516-620-3206 or go to our site for info. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on Sunday the 29th with a preview of this year's Vision Fest. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Hello, this is Hugh Masekela in New York. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. Don't lose your mind. Don't move that dial. Don't groove to anything else.
We seem to be switching areas now, but I want Margaret to mention the date, time, website.
So the date is May 26th. The time is 7 p.m. It's going to be at our apartment. People have to reserve online at my website at www.harlemartswithansalon.com, and they will find a portal there to buy a ticket to get in. And because it's in our home, it is private, so we have to verify people before they come. You know what I mean? It's just not open to the general public like that, lest they prepay and we can talk to them and make sure.
Actually, I was wondering about that since this is a public broadcast and you don't have it's not like a coliseum.
It's not like a coliseum. It's not like a big movie theater or anything like that. So we can only accommodate so many people.
Right.
So it's limited seating.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important to know.
Right.
Limited seating, and it's filling up very fast, as you can well imagine, with that kind of list of guests.
Sure.
And because of the occasion.
Excellent. Now, I'm going to just cut the chase, cut through the everything. And the first thing I thought about when I heard about the Don Cheadle movie and the creation of a relationship with a writer who is Caucasian, they had to create this character in order to sell the film, apparently. Now, the first thing I thought about was, why would you want to make up a relationship when there was already a relationship with a writer? And that would be you, Quincy Troupe.
I think that, M2Me and myself, Warrington Hutland, on March 30th, before the movie came out, he had a screening at the Museum of Moving Images.
Oh, in Queens.
Astoria, Queens.
Yes.
And he called and asked me and James M2Me, Miles's former percussionist, to be a respondent to the movie. And they would show the movie, and then M2Me and I, he and I are friends, would critique, in a way, the movie.
Sure.
And so we did that. So we went out there, and this place was packed to the brim. It was people overflowing. They had to pay, and they were like hanging like bats from the ceiling. It was so crowded.
I hate that we weren't able to come and hang like bats.
It was packed to the brim.
Uh-huh.
So we saw that, and so when we got there, M2 and I were just talking about what we were going to do, and we didn't know what, we hadn't seen the film. Nobody had seen the film because it wasn't out yet.
Right.
It came out on April 1st, so this is March 30th. So Warrington Hudlin, whose brother is Reginald Hudlin, who is also a film director, and they're both from East St. Louis.
Oh.
And they grew up, and their father knew Miles, and I'm from St. Louis, and so my cousin, Eddie Randall, was the first band Miles played in when he was 17 years old and got paid. Mm-hmm. So that was my cousin, who was a big undertaker in St. Louis, and he had this great band, too. He played trumpet also. So we all went back a long ways with Miles Davis, and although I met him later in 1985. M2Me knew him before. We were there talking about what we were going to talk about, even though we hadn't seen the film. And Warrington came up and said, look, because the family and Columbia Pictures and our board of directors are a little nervous about what you're going to say about the movie, because I already knew that Columbia Pictures didn't think it was good, because I have a contact in there.
Okay.
And because we're doing this film on Miles that's going to come out next year. And I knew that the movie was not being reviewed or critique well. And so they asked Warrington to let us go first and to talk about our relationship with Miles instead of showing the film first and then M2Me and myself talking about critiquing the movie, because they thought we were going to destroy it and they wanted to make their money back.
Sure.
That's basically the bottom line.
Of course.
And so when Warrington asked me that, I told him, okay, man, I mean, I don't understand that. What do you want us to talk about? He said, let's talk about your relationship with Miles. I said, fine. So then M2Me agreed. So we go out on stage in front of this packed audience, maybe, I don't know, 750 to 1,000 people or something. And they were in there. And so after I got through talking about my relationship wasn't in Tume, they asked for questions. And this one guy asked, Mr. Troop, could you please tell me, did Don Cheadle ask for your input on the film? I said, no.
Mm.
He asked M2Me. M2Me said, no. And so then he asked me, why do you think that he did not ask you for your input? I said, frankly speaking, I think that the reason he didn't ask me was because he already had in his head the film he was going to make. And so he didn't want to ask me because he was scared to ask me because I might destroy the concept he had. And I said, and when I saw that he was going to make this film on the dark period of Miles's life from 1975 to 1980, when he didn't play, wasn't playing no music, wasn't doing anything but sitting in his house, I was curious why he picked that particular part of Miles's life to do a film on. And then I came to the conclusion in my own head, I didn't say it, I said to my wife, that then I figured that he could do anything he wanted to do, because a lot of people didn't know, except I knew, because I had interviewed Miles, what he did during that dark period when he didn't play. He told me in the book, I got it on tape, what he did. I knew what he did. That was the first thing. I said, wow, that's interesting. Then the second thing he did was that he called Miles Davis a OG, a old gangster.
Yeah.
Now, how could he say that? Because he didn't even know Miles Davis. He never met him in his life.
Right.
So he called him that. I said, that's crazy, because everybody that knew Miles Davis knew he was not. He was never, ever a gangster.
Right.
Never. So that was just stupid. And I didn't understand that. But as time went on, he began to edit his statement. He went from calling him an OG to being that he did this and so on and so on. And then at the last thing he said, this is a historical fiction. And I said, oh, it's a historical cultural fiction.
Wow.
I said, oh, okay. And he said that before, right before the movie came out. And I just kind of listed all those kind of things in my head. So when I went to see it, when the guy said, well, what do you think it's going to be? I said, well, I'll tell you what. I told this guy what I just told you. That first he said he did it on a dark period. That he called him an OG, which he wasn't. And then he didn't have any music. He couldn't have any music at that point. So I thought it was just strange that he would do that. And then Don didn't know him. So I had in my head that this was going to be off. I didn't know what he was going to be. So Margaret and I, my wife and I, went and sat in the back with a painter friend of ours to watch the movie. And the guy whom we knew, really great, really, really fine painter, he's a white guy. And we were sitting there, he was a Miles Davis fanatic. He loved Miles. And we were sitting in the back. And when that movie came on, everybody was, we were looking at each other aghast. You know what I mean? Like, this is insane. You know, it's a just crazy, you know? I thought that, to be truthful with you, Don Cheadle tried to get into Miles, but what he did was probably took a series of photographs, films, all that, and what he failed to do, I thought, was to let Miles inhabit him, to become Miles. He did not become Miles. He was acting like what he thought Miles was, which was not the way Miles Davis was. See, so a lot of people who didn't know Miles might think that it was Miles, but that was just a caricature.
Right.
With a bad wig on his head.
Wow.
And a poor selection of clothes. Mm. You know, and he didn't have a Jaguar at that time. And, you know, so I was like, God, this is crazy. And I know this is long, but then I'll stop in about a minute or two.
No problem.
And then I thought that, wow, this guy, and he's doing it on this dark period. So everybody who's going to see this movie who does not know Miles Davis, doesn't know anything about Miles, especially young people, black or white or whatever, they're not going to know what the real Miles Davis was. They're not, because they didn't hear music. They saw him in there sometime trying to do what he was doing. And the other thing was the car chases, the shootouts, the roach on the ground crawling. Mm. You know, they had that roach on the ground, him running around with the lost, so-called lost music. That didn't happen. None of that happened.
No.
You know, the shootout didn't happen. Mm. The car chases didn't happen. Him beating up people at the fight didn't happen. Mm. You know, him getting locked out of his own house by a white guy, that didn't happen. And swinging at the guy and not hitting him. I'm like, what is this, man? This is like ridiculous. You know what I mean? The whole thing was ridiculous.
Wow.
But then I realized what he was doing, and he picked a white guy because of the fact that he wanted to make his money back. I mean, that's just a cynical way to do that. I mean, if he wanted to pick a white guy, he should have picked Ralph Gleason, who was a friend of Miles, who was a critic, who was Miles' favorite critic, who, right. You know, and that was his friend, for real. He was a white guy.
Right.
And he didn't, Miles Davis did not like writers, period. He liked Ralph, and then he liked me.
Right.
Okay, he liked me, because he picked me to do his book.
Right.
And I think the reason he picked me to do his book was that first, Ralph was dead, and then I was from St. Louis, and I had done this two-part piece on him for Spin Magazine, and he grew to trust me and like me, you know? And Miles Davis, he had to trust you. So he picked this white guy to run around with him. First, the other thing is Miles would have never let somebody drive his car. Mm. That was also open. It was just too crazy for me. It was just off the chain.
Well, there's one thing I thought that was really insane was not only, you know, I guess, you know, Miles wouldn't let the white guy drive his car. He wouldn't let the white guy just yell at him, Miles!
No, he wouldn't.
Like he was as though he were a child.
I was going to get to that. You beat me. No, Miles was not a poop butt. He was not a poop butt. He didn't allow no. See, we were with some really wealthy white people, and this one guy came up to me and said, you know what? I knew Miles. I was his photographer. I said, what? And he said, yeah. He said, Miles Davis was a god. He was a god. He was like that. He was a god. Now, I didn't think of him as a god, because I knew him really close, but he was an otherworldly in a lot of ways. Right. You know, his power, the power of Miles Davis was otherworldly. Mm-hmm. So for the white boy to be screaming at Miles, that would not have happened. It just wouldn't have happened, see? It just wouldn't have happened, you know, because he didn't allow that kind of stuff.
No.
He didn't allow that kind of stuff.
Allow anyone to yell at him.
No. No, you know, he didn't allow it. He didn't allow it. I mean, he and I got into it a lot.
Sure.
We got into it, but I mean, you know, I didn't scream at him like that.
Right.
You know, he just didn't allow anything like that. So all those things, the premise of that is because Miles Davis, when he would walk in the room, he commanded respect. Mm-hmm. I went to a number of parties with him. When he walked in the room, I don't care where it was, rich people, everything, everybody stopped talking. And they start whispering, there's Miles Davis. And they go, oh, God. You know, I mean, that's the way he was wherever he went. And I never saw anybody disrespect him. Never. And all the musicians that knew him, that played with him, loved him.
Right.
I interviewed all of them. They all loved Miles. And all the musicians who didn't play with him respected him so much, they wanted to play with him. They were all waiting for that call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I know that, too.
And people remember how the call went.
Oh, yeah.
Because we often ask them, what was the call like? And everyone can tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Their call.
Oh, yeah. When he picked me to write that book, I was totally excited, you know. And when I walked in his house in Malibu, you know, he said to me, yeah, Quincy, I got you a gig, didn't I? He said, a real good gig. He said, you might not know it now, but you're going to know it later.
Wow.
I cracked up. It's true.
Yeah. So, Miles and Me, the book Miles and Me.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about, well, first off, you start at the beginning. You don't start at some weird period in Miles's life. So how did you come to the point after? Well, I guess this was after the biography.
Yeah. What happened was Miles told me one day, he said to me, Quincy, I know you want to write another book about me. Everybody want to write about me. He said, you want to write about me, don't you? I said, you write about that, man. I'm going to get you. I said, I'm going to get you, man. He cracked up. Mm. He said, do me a favor. I said, what? He said, don't write about me until I'm dead.
Mm.
I said, okay. I said, you got that. You got it. I won't write about you until you're dead, but you're going to live a while. He said, that remains to be seen.
Wow.
Because I think Miles, nobody in his family lived real long. Everybody died when they were in their 60s, 65, 67, 68, from his father to his sisters to his brothers.
Wow.
His uncles, they all died in that range from 63 to, and one of his sons just died now.
So oh, my.
They all lived between 63 and 67, 68. I think his brother lived longer than anybody. He lived to be 68. And so he always knew that he was going to die young, I think. He didn't ever talk about it. But I felt that he knew he was not going to live long. So he was always in a race for time to do his music and everything, get his whole thing into some kind of order. So when he said that, he knew what he was talking about. So I didn't. I respected that. And I didn't write about it until he died. And then after that, it was 1991. When he died in 1991, September 28th. I didn't start that book until 1998-99. And so that book was to talk about our friendship, because we had this really great, interesting friendship with me and my wife and my family, and not too many people saw him. And I thought that it would make a good memoir.
Is there a part that you wanted to read from the book?
This is from Miles and Me, the prologue. Miles Davis was a great poet on his instrument. His horn could blow warm, round notes that spoke to the deepest human emotions. And it could spit out cracked trills that evoked the angry sounds of bullets firing. Sometimes his trumpet seemed to float over and through remarkably complex rhythms and time signatures with heart-stopping speed and efficiency. His sound could penetrate like a sharp knife. It could also be muted, tender, and low, like a lullaby, but it was always charged with deeply felt human emotion. Miles' sound always made us sit up and take notice, listen. It was burnished, brooding, unforgettable. When you heard Miles on the radio, you knew right away that it was him. You knew it by the sound, because no one else ever sounded like that. Like Louis Armstrong's sound, Duke Ellington's, Thelonious Monk's, John Coltrane's, his voice was unmistakably unique. Sometimes when he used the mute, whether on up-tempo tunes or slow ones, we knew we were hearing perfection. When he played muted ballads, it was as if he were tenderly kissing our feelings. Then he would stun us with bright, rapid-fire bursts of notes that penetrated our souls. Miles not only soliloquized, he also had a dialoguing style. It was like listening to him having a conversation with himself, with one of his voices imitating a fast-talking, sweet-rapping black street hustler. Even when he first was starting out, Miles' sound and style got your attention immediately, because you knew whatever he played, it was going to be unusual. His music was always unusual, because that's the way his mind worked, unusually. Miles Davis was always unusual. He didn't just get that way after he became famous. He was special from the beginning, and all his homeboys told me so.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Quincy Troop, for sharing that bit of Miles and Me. And if people want more from what they just heard, they can contact WBAI. Call us at
thank you.
About Miles and Me. Of course, it's your own documenting of your relationship. The fact that you've decided to make a film about it, or create a screenplay to present a film, why did you feel the need to do that?
Well, when this book came out in 2000, 2001, by the way, this book has been translated into 20-some languages also. And Miles, the autobiography, into 30-some languages.
Nice.
But when it first came out, I went on a tour. I went to all over the United States. But when I was in Los Angeles, in the middle of Hollywood, I went on to two biggest shows in L.A., one in the morning and one in the afternoon. I was interviewed by the two top disc jockeys about the book, and I read excerpts and talked about it. And when I got through, both of them said to me, one was in Pasadena and one was in West Los Angeles, but they both said to me, man, I'm telling you, Quincy, this phone is going to light up, and it's going to be a lot of movie producers want to talk to you about this book to make a movie. Mm. I said, really? And they said, yeah, watch. And so when I got back to New York, they both called me on the phone and told me they had about 10 producers in Hollywood that wanted to talk to me about optioning my book and to make a film. And they were willing to pay top dollar. And so I was like, whoa. And he said, so you better get ready for it. Can I give them your number? And I said, yeah. I said, give them my number, but give me a week. And they said, okay. In the meantime, I called my good friend Danny Glover, who was the great actor and who I've known before he was really famous as an actor. He was working for the city of San Francisco when I met him, you know, and we've been friends for a long time. So I called him on the phone and I asked him, I said, man, the guy told me they're going to be calling me and asking me to option my book and to make it into a movie. What do you think? Because you're in Hollywood. He said, if I were you, if you don't need the money, I said, well, all poets need money, man. What are you talking about? I said, I'm not like you doing these big parts. He said, no, I mean, are you broke or do you? I said, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And so he said, well, I would try to get an independent person to make this film. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, some of the calls start coming and they were offering this money. He said, because what they're going to do is ironic. He said, if they get the movie, they're going to turn you into a white boy.
Mm.
And it's ironic that that's what Don Cheadle did.
Right.
You know what I mean? He said, so I wouldn't, if you want to have control over this film, I would get an independent person. I would wait for an independent to do it. And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. I waited for an independent film company to do it. And when the person called me who was doing the film, Rudy Langlais, who was odd because he had been my editor on the piece I wrote for Spin magazine, the two-part article I wrote for Spin, that was the reason that I got to do Miles's book was right. Because of that piece. And he was the one that called me, and I didn't know where he was. And he said, well, I left print medium and moved from New York to Los Angeles to start making films. And I made Sugar Hill, which I saw, but I didn't remember seeing his name later. And then he made The Hurricane with Denzel Washington.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, wow, you made that? Wow, that's out. And he said, I would like to do this film. And so that's how I started to do it. So I asked him, I said, well, who's going to write the script? He said, you are.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm going to write it. He said, yeah. I said, well, I've never written a film script before. He said, but you can do it. You're a poet. Poets write better scripts than anybody else, and then I'll help you get through it.
Oh,
and that's how that happened. It happened like that, you know.
Nice.
And so for the next, it's been like 10 years, you know, to do this, because with black films, you have to, especially if it's about two strong African-American men, Hollywood doesn't jump at that. If it was a comedian and, you know, that kind of debauchery and stupidity, they'll do that. They'll do those kind of films right quick. But if it's about a friendship between two strong men, they're not too willing to do that. That's why the money was raised independently, because nobody wanted to do it, you know, because they historically don't want to do that. And they don't want to show that. And that's a strange thing. That's why I've always been advocating that black people, African-American people, we have to make our own films and get the money if we're going to make films about strong people. And as well, get our own distributing system.
Right.
Our own movie theaters. Everything, the whole thing, from top to bottom. And so the work on this film and doing this film has also proven that to me. That's why I decided to do it, not because I had thought about doing it, but the people, when they started talking about this would make a great film, then that's when I started really thinking about it.
So when next year are we looking at?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure. I don't like to say, he's saying like the fall.
Okay.
See, what is happening, I can't mention the name of the person, but he's a really famous person who he wants to be director. And the guy wants to do it, but he's a good friend of my producer, Rudy Langlais.
Uh-huh.
We have people in Vancouver and Toronto and Paris and some other people who have put the money up for this film. So that's what's happening with it. So they want to bring it out next fall, 2017.
But for now, people can read the book, which is always better anyway, Miles and Me. Yeah. And you can help WBAI by reading this book as well. And you can call. Is there anything else, Margaret and Quincy, you want to tell the WBAI listenership?
The phone number they can call if they want information about the May 26th celebration. Call 212-749-7771.
One more time.
212-749-7771.
And for those who are friendly with the internet?
For the internet friendly folks, they may reserve online at our website, www.harlemartssalon.com, and that's harlemartssalon.com.
Great. Quincy?
I think they should. I think people should. I'm serious when I say this. This is not a sales pitch, but I think they really want to come. They should get their tickets
immediately.
Yeah, immediately when they hear this, because there were people that we met, and these were Fifth Avenue people, and they were calling in already when I told them about it. I'm serious.
You know?
So
it's limited seating.
It's limited seating. Yeah.
Right. They would be wise to reserve their seats as soon as possible.
Yes, that was stated earlier for those who forgot. Limited seating, and there's a process, because not everybody can attend. So respond now.
Right.
Just like calling WBAI as well and going to give the number to WBAI. You need to act now.
I agree.
And I just wanted to thank you again for giving us the opportunity to publicize the program, and thank you for being such a great service to the community.
Oh, and thank you for doing Thank you both for doing the same for so long and continuing to do the same. So have a great night. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of the program of which you've been listening. My name's Joyce Jones, and what you're listening to right now is Prelude, Part 2, Miles Davis, Agartha, his 1976 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet and organ, Sonny Fortune on soprano and alto sax, also flute, Michael Henderson on Fender bass, Pete Cozy on guitar, synthy, and percussion, Al Foster on drums, Reggie Lucas on guitar, and M. Tume on conga and percussion. Before that, we heard Honky Tonk from Miles Davis's Get Up With It, his 1974 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Steve Grossman on soprano sax, John McLaughlin on guitar, Keith Jarrett on Fender Rhodes, Herbie Hancock on clavinet, Michael Henderson on electric bass, Billy Cobham on drums, and Ayerto Moreira on percussion. Before that, we heard What It Is, Miles Davis from Decoy, his release, his 1984 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, synthesizer, Mino Sinilu on percussion, Sinilu, Mino Sinilu on percussion, Bill Evans on soprano saxophone, Al Foster on drums, Daryl the Munch Jones on electric bass, and John Scofield on guitar. Before that, we heard The Pan Piper from Miles Davis's Sketches of Spain, his 1960 Columbia Records release. And that has Miles Davis on trumpet, and Gil Evans is responsible for the arrangements, and he is also the conductor. He was also the conductor. Before that, we heard 81 from Miles Davis's ESP, his 1965 Columbia Records release. Miles Davis on trumpet, Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, Herbie Hancock on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Tony Williams on drums. And after our On the Bandstand segment and our station ID, we heard Don't Lose Your Mind. I was sort of thinking of the promo that was voiced by Hugh Masekela. Don't Lose Your Mind, Miles Davis, from his 1986 Columbia Records release Tutu. It's produced by Tommy La Puma, who was mentioned earlier and will be at the May 26th Harlem Art Salon event to help the Gloucester Arts Project that Margaret Porter Troop and Quincy Troop will be presenting. There's also Marcus Miller also produced this recording. Miles Davis on trumpet, Marcus Miller on all other instruments, Michael except for the electric violin, where Michael Urbaniak is playing. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. What you need to do is go to give2wbai.org or call 516-620-3206. That's 516-620-3206 to show your support for WBAI. And for a pledge of $35, you can receive as a thank you the book Miles and Me, written by Quincy Troop. We discussed this earlier during the broadcast. That's 212-209-2950 or, oh, that's 516-620-3206, 516-620-3206, or give the number to WBAI.org. We need you to show your support and keep this listener-supported experiment alive, and also to keep Sugar in My Bowl on the air. If you like the program, people have told me they do, show your support to WBAI by calling 516-620-3206, 516-620-3206, or go to give the number 2 WBAI.org. That's give the number 2 WBAI.org, where you will be able to find the premium Miles and Me, the book, for a pledge of $35. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. We'll be back on May 29th with our Vision Festival program, as WBAI is once again a media sponsor of that event. Stay tuned.